Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cogliano. I usually at this point ask how you're doing, Frank, but we're in some weird times. How are you doing?
We are in very weird times. I'm fine. Thank you for asking. I guess if I were going to describe my state right now, it would be distracted.
As are we all.
Is the best. Yeah, indeed. But we have something fun to do today.
Yes, we definitely do. And for those of you listeners, I guess we're planning on addressing all the things that are going on in a soon to be coming future episode. But Frank, we've got a special guest today. You want to introduce our special guest?
We do. Our guest today is Kristen Blackstone, and Kristen, who's been on the podcast before, but Kristen, we're going to have a chat with Kristen today about her PhD research, because she is just about completing her draft dissertation and about to submit her dissertation, and so we want to talk to her about her work. And we were planning to do this before the events of the last week unfolded. So it's important to say, I know a couple of people have contacted us on Twitter and asked us what we think. I've got to confess a kind of ambivalence. I was ambivalent last week about speaking about the killing of George Floyd and the its immediate aftermath, in part because of our distance literally from the United States at this time. But I think that as events have unfolded and over the past week, there's a lot for us to consider and to mull over and to respond to, and we're planning to do that in our next episode. But we had invited Kristen before all these events began to unfold, and we wanted to honor that commitment, and we wanted to talk to Kristen. So that's the reason we're interviewing her today. So without further ado, Kristen, welcome back to the podcast.
And thank you for having me.
Yeah, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay, yeah. I mean, as you said, I'm finishing my dissertation, so busy, but doing well.
Okay, great to hear. And before we talk about your dissertation, which is going to be our main focus, tell us a little bit about yourself. I suspect that people listening to the podcast, and the three of us are here in Edinburgh, in different parts of Edinburgh right now, having this conversation, they will likely conclude that you are not Scottish by birth.
So I would imagine that will have come up, yes.
So tell us about yourself. Tell us who you are, Kristen.
So, as Frank said, my name is Kristen Blackstone. I'm originally from a very small town in northern Maine called Parham, and lived in northern Maine until I was 18, at which point I decided to move to Scotland to study history at university. So I actually moved to Edinburgh almost 9 years ago. It'll be 9 years in 2 months, which doesn't seem possible. But I did my undergrad degree at the University of Edinburgh in history and Scottish history, because that's why I moved originally. I really wanted to study Scottish history. And then I got to Scotland and decided that actually I didn't. I wanted to study American history. But at that point, I liked living in Scotland so much I didn't want to leave. So I just haven't. I did my master's in American history here, and I'm now at my final year of my PhD.
Right. So you will have 3 degrees from the University of Edinburgh.
I will. And actually, very fun. So for those of you that don't know about Edinburgh's graduation ceremony, we have a graduation hall. All graduation ceremonies are in, except my first two, because McEwen Hall was under renovations. So despite having 3 degrees from Edinburgh, my PhD will be my only one that I actually march in McEwen Hall for.
Right. Well, I'm glad you stuck around then. So where did
yes.
you graduate?
Usher Hall.
Right. Well, that's not bad either.
It's not. No, I can't complain.
Good. So, Kristen, tell us what you're – give us the elevator. You know, we often encourage PhD students and junior colleagues to be able to give what we call the elevator pitch, you know, the kind of two-minute version of what your dissertation is about, so that they can explain it to strangers and to visitors, and more importantly to people who are interviewing them for jobs. So give us the elevator pitch, and then we'll take it from there. What's your thesis about?
My dissertation is entitled The Hardest Conflict, Morale in the Continental Army from 1775 to 1783. And it does what it says in the title. It examines determinants of morale in the Continental Army, specifically amongst enlisted soldiers. So while I consider officers, I'm mostly concerned with soldiers who enlist as kind of ordinary soldiers at the lower rank in the army and their time in the war. The reason that I wanted to study morale, one, is just because no one has studied morale in the Continental Army because it's not really an 18th century word that exists. It's much more of a 20th century military history framework, if you will. But by studying morale, you get, or I get, a very good view of the soldier's understanding of their own experience, which I think is something that's missing. So to do that, I primarily focus on diaries. I've read over 300 diaries from the conflict, of enlisted soldiers and of officers. And the goal is to really understand not only why did soldiers agree to fight during the Revolutionary War, but why do they continue to fight during the war for those that fight for more than one enlisted period, and what things keep them in the army and kind of force them out of the army or cause them to desert or cause them not to reenlist.
So excellent. Thank you, Kristen. That's a good elevator pitch. Your timing was excellent.
Thank you.
So what's your main argument? What's the takeaway? Or as I always ask you, so what?
So what? So the so what, I guess, or the main argument for me is that morale in the Continental Army, well, I should say overall, morale is cultural, which means while you can study morale in any particular army, the things that influence that morale is going to be different depending on the culture surrounding the army and society's understanding of where the army fits into that. And that's a very important thing. So many of the things that I think determine morale in the Continental Army would determine morale in any army in any conflict, but there are some that are specific to the Continental Army, just as there would be different ones for the Crown forces during the same period or the French Revolutionary armies, et cetera, et cetera. So my argument is that there are three kind of main categories that influence morale. The first is institutional morale, which is both the morale of the Continental Army as a whole, and how that is influenced. And that can be anything from very practical things like supply lines to overall success of the army in victory. There is relational morale, that is how tied the soldiers feel to the other soldiers that they're fighting and how convinced that they are that they need to be in the army. And finally, cohesion overall is a big thing. So both cohesion within society and within the army itself. Morale, I've decided, is both individual and collective. That is, individuals can have high and low morale, and that can be different from the other person, but also understanding the army's morale as a whole is equally as important.
Okay, that's great. I've got loads of questions.
Can I ask just a little question first, Frank?
Yeah, please.
I'm just curious about these diaries. Like, what physically do they look like? What does a Revolutionary War diary look like, and what kinds of soldiers kept diaries?
That's a really good question. The answer is it really depends on the individual soldier, for a number of reasons. One, just the availability of material. So you have a lot of soldiers who do have physical diaries. They'd be small pocket-sized diaries that they write in, and they kind of write all over the diaries. They write in the margins. They doodle pictures. You have others that are just on individual scraps of paper that they find. A lot of the diaries that were kept, I have never seen the original version of. I have seen scans of the original version, or they have been published subsequently, but it really depends on the available material for the soldiers. In terms of what type of soldiers keep diaries, that is also very diverse. Literacy rates in this period, especially in soldiers from New England, are actually relatively high. Literacy rate in New England amongst men in this period, which means that lots of soldiers keep diaries, from very lower class, low ranked soldiers all the way up through officers. The difference being the content of those diaries, I guess. So enlisted soldiers tend to write very short declarative statements about things in their daily lives. So they will write how many miles they've marched. They will talk about the weather. Observations of the things around them they see. They rarely talk about emotions. They rarely talk about battles, actually, even presumably because they're kind of busy during battles. But they're very short, not particularly descriptive, and they keep a record of every day in the conflict. Whereas better educated soldiers, or soldiers who are officers or have a trade in the army, if they are a surgeon or if they are a reverend, they will keep much more detailed diaries that are paragraphs and paragraphs long per entry. They don't necessarily keep them every day, and they're not necessarily concerned with observations of the world around them. They will comment much less on the weather and much less on the miles marched, but instead will comment on the state of the army and what people are doing and how things are going and general feelings and sentiments of both the army and of the society surrounding them. So diaries in this period, as I would imagine diaries in all conflicts are very diverse, but there are a lot of them, which is great.
Do you have a favorite?
Do I have a favorite? Yes, I think so. I guess there's two that I really enjoy. The first is Elijah Fisher's. So he is from Massachusetts, but he spent most of his life after the revolution in Maine. And as I said earlier, I'm from Maine, so always to see that. And he started his diary.
Hold on. Of course, for much of his life, Maine
was Massachusetts. It was not Maine. Yes, that is correct.
Anyway, carry on.
That is correct, yes. But he lived in what is now considered the state of Maine for most of his life. And he started his diary during the Revolutionary War, but he continued to keep it after the war and kept it for most of his life. So if you go to the Maine Historical Society, his papers are massive. They start in 1775 and they continue on through most of his life. And that's really rare. And at least in what I found, I've gotten to read lots of diaries, which is amazing, but I rarely get to read papers after the war. And they include his financial papers, genealogies of his family that he wrote, and just seeing such a comprehensive collection of his papers was really, really great. My other favorite is the diary of Elihu Marshall, and it's at the Society of the Cincinnati in Washington, D.C. And it's my favorite for a number of reasons. One, because it's the first fully intact physical diary that I got to look at. And two, because he doodles in his diary, which sometimes happens, but not nearly as frequently as he does. And he's on the Sullivan expedition for a lot of his diary, and he doodles things like Native American war mallets that he's seen, and he doodles the patterns, and he doodles battlefield movements. He has like signatures from him and his friends at the beginning and end of the journal, which I think was something I didn't consider that people in the 18th century did, but obviously I think lots of people, when they're growing up as kids, they will kind of practice their signature on the corners of sheets of paper that they have. So that was really interesting to see. I think those are my two favorites.
So, Kristen, what other sources did you use in addition to diaries?
I have used a lot of sources. So diaries are my primary sources in terms of material relating to soldiers' perceptions. I also looked at pension records as supplementary material, because pension records are a really rich source of information about soldier service and also what they think about it and what their families think about it. I'm slightly dubious of using pension records on their own because they are written after the war and for a very specific purpose. Obviously, these soldiers are fighting for pensions in compensation for their service. And so they are not necessarily as contemporary as diaries. They're not written necessarily in the moment that a soldier is experiencing the war. And when evaluating in morale, that complicates things slightly. Regardless, but pension records are a really great source as well. I was lucky enough to read lots of letters that soldiers have written or that families have written to soldiers. Upsettingly, with letters, there is rarely, especially in enlisted soldiers, collections of letters that are full. So often I will get an individual letter from a soldier or an individual letter from a soldier's wife to him, but I rarely get to see the back and forth of letters, at least in enlisted soldiers. There are obviously Henry Knox and his wife Lucy have a huge correspondence of letters, which is wonderful. And of course, people like John and Abigail Adams obviously have a huge correspondence as well. I consider orderly books, which are what they sound like. They are a collection of orders. Orderly books are a really interesting source because individual soldiers tend to keep them for the regiment, but it means that often soldiers will change words from the original order, or they'll add in their own thoughts And it is a diary orderly book hybrid a lot of the time, which is really interesting to study. And so I end up looking at the original orders that were issued by Washington or whatever officer issued them that day, and then get to compare them with the orderly book that the soldier wrote down. And then other than that, correspondence more generally between Continental Congress and officers, or colonial governors and officers. Colonial governors play a really important role in the supply line of the war and in enlisting soldiers and giving kind of support from their end. And so all of the correspondence that is available at the time, I think I have tried to read as it relates to the Army. And then finally, newspapers are also really interesting, and pamphlets that come out at this period, because I think to understand what the Army feels and is experiencing during this period, you also have to understand how the society around them is treating them and how the society feels about them. And newspapers are a relatively good gauge of that. And especially newspapers telling of events that happen is very interesting as well.
So, Kristen, you've obviously used loads and loads of different sources. What's the biggest challenge you faced in doing your research?
That's interesting. I think there's three challenges, I guess, and they're all very distinct from one another. The first was wrapping my head around studying morale without necessarily attempting to measure it. I think given the sources that I have, it would be impossible for me to go through the war and say morale is high on this day and it is not high on this day. And so figuring out how to study morale, analyze morale without giving, because everyone asks, you know, how is morale? Or they'll, when I tell them I'm studying morale, I'll be like, oh, morale, well, there's your thesis, which is not inaccurate. But I think finding the nuance and finding how I'm describing what I'm doing has been a challenge that I'm still currently working through finishing my thesis, but a very interesting kind of intellectual challenge for me. The second one is with the sources. There obviously, as I said, there's a huge selection of primary sources that I've been privileged to study, and I was lucky enough to receive multiple research fellowships that brought me to the U.S. so I could see all of these sources in person, the ones that were available. But a lot of the sources in this period were published in the 19th century. Different historical societies published them, individuals published them, and there is always a slight concern using a published source if you can't also see the original, because what if they took out information, or what if they changed phrases? And sometimes you can tell roughly by the source that they haven't changed anything. And then sometimes you're like, oh, actually, I think there's more to this diary that was left out. Interestingly, while I was at one of the libraries that I was researching at, a diary was brought to the library to be authenticated and as a potential for their collection. And it's a diary that had been transcribed previously, but the transcription kept the entirety of the diary, but left the first like 6 pages in the book that it was written. And it was basically a religious letter that the author wrote, I think to himself, but also more broadly to whoever was to read this diary, about his position on the war and why he was fighting and how that connected to his own personal beliefs. And I thought it was very interesting that the person who transcribed the diary didn't include that, because obviously it is not part of the diary as in not part of his daily notations, but it is clearly part of his thinking about why he is fighting. And it is in his diary. It's the very first thing in the physical booklet that was the diary. So that has been an interesting challenge, just knowing what sources to trust, when to dig a bit further into a particular source origins. And then the final challenge for me personally is I have never kept a diary myself. It's just not something I have ever thought to do. And I think part of that is because I'm very talkative. And so if I have a thought, I just kind of say it to whoever is near me. And so understanding why these soldiers would keep these diaries every day, the mechanics of writing the diary, why would you bother to write something down if all you're writing down is the weather? But then we entered lockdown and have been in lockdown for almost 3 months now. And as part of lockdown, as I think a lot of people have been doing, I decided to start keeping a diary. And originally it was mostly just of my thoughts. There were some days where all I wrote was, it was sunny today, I didn't go outside. But as it progressed, it's kind of become a bohemian diary that I've kept. And there was a period for about 3 weeks that I didn't keep any notes. And I don't know why, I just wasn't in the mood to write anything. So I had that 3 week period that actually I needed to write kind of a summary of everything that I could remember that happened over those 3 weeks, because there was a lot of things both politically and personally that had happened that I wanted to write down, which was a very interesting exercise, because in my research I discovered that lots of soldiers copy each other's diaries. And I don't mean copy in a negative sense, as if they were plagiarizing others' diaries, but you'll have a series of diaries from expeditions where for an entire month, all of the soldiers say the exact same thing in the exact same way with the exact same punctuation. And there's no way that all of these individuals wrote each of these entries. Basically, one person has written them and then others have copied down what the original person wrote. And I couldn't figure out for the life within me why that was. And as I was, you know, dealing with COVID and writing my own diary and writing the summary, I have a feeling it is just because they, for some reason, didn't want to write notes themselves, but they wanted a record of what was going on during that time. And if the person sat next to them, who's experiencing all of the same things, I mean, his emotions might be slightly different, but all the things that are happening to them and the marches that they're taking, the weather they're experiencing is the same. And so it was much easier to just copy down that person's record. So at the end of the war, for later on in life, they too have kind of a complete experience of what they did, which has been a very interesting shift for me in the past couple months.
So are you planning to keep your diary after the COVID-19 lockdown ends?
I think I am. I am not particularly confident that I will keep one keep a record of something I do every single day, but I think all my thoughts about lockdown, about the world, about random political, just about how I'm feeling, and I think I will continue to do so.
Interesting. So about your actual research itself and the findings, does morale have an impact on the course of the War of Independence?
That's a really interesting question. I think it does, for a couple reasons. Firstly, I think there's a conflation in terms when people are studying the Revolutionary War, and actually just an understanding of morale in general, where people equate spirit to morale. And I think they're two very different things. But in the historiography of the Revolution, spirit is something that is emphasized very strongly and has been for the past 40-ish years, where the story that we hear is that in 1775, you have these flaming patriots who are zealous in the cause and their spirits are really high. And after 1775, that dies down. And I don't think that's inaccurate. I think that's completely true. But spirit is, my understanding of it, as especially as it relates to morale, spirit can be a momentary elevation. So they win a battle, soldier spirits are elevated. Whereas morale is much more of a culmination of emotions and of both very practical and psychological factors. And so while spirit is very high in 1775 and then declines throughout the war, morale, I think, becomes much more steady. So as far as I can tell, I have two chapters that look at kind of expressions of dissatisfaction. So I look at mutiny and I look at desertion. And I think these are the chapters that best answer this question. Soldiers desert most commonly the first 6 months that they are enlisted, which means that the longer that they are in the army, the more likely they are to stay for whatever reason. I think the reason is the group cohesion. After 6 months, they're kind of inculcated to the values of what's going on, why they're fighting. They formed bonds with the people they are fighting with. They have loyalties and they will continue to do so. Desertion is also highest at times of organizational shift in the army. So when the big changes that go on to how the army functions. So at the end of 1775, a lot of soldiers leave the army because they were kind of a group of militiamen who were just told in June that you are now the army. And at the end of that year, they didn't like the shift from militia to the army. Whereas soldiers in 1778, for instance, who enlisted in 1777, they understand what the army's like. There isn't a major organizational shift. Their training patterns change, but in general, what they expected and what they received when they enlisted staying relatively steady. And so I think the consistency as the army grows means that soldiers will stay in the war, soldiers are more likely to stay in the army, and that morale is less dependent on those fluctuations, whereas early in the war, it's very dependent on those fluctuations. So I do think that the progress of the war, morale is really important in the progress of the war, and really important in getting soldiers, especially towards the end of the war, to stay in the army. Enlistment becomes a problem. It's a problem throughout the entire war, but it becomes a problem particularly at the end of the war, because no one expected this to be an 8-year conflict. And by 1780, people are really not happy with the fact that it's still going on. Soldiers really don't want to join. And so it's all the more important that soldiers stay in the army. It's not kind of the enlisted motivations, it's the motivations that soldiers need to continue. And that's where morale comes in, and that's where it's really important. So yeah, I think it really does help the outcome of the war by getting that kind of group of soldiers from 1777 onwards to stay in the army as long as possible.
How does morale in the Continental Army compare to morale in the British Army during the war?
This is interesting. So morale, as I said at the very beginning, is, as a term, it's not an 18th century term. It's in English, at least. It is in French, although in French it conflates quite strongly with the word moral. It actually still conflates quite strongly. The number of people that ask me what I'm studying, they take it that I'm talking about morality instead of morale. It happens all the time. But because it is military theory, if you will, the importance of an individual soldier's morale in the late 18th century, but it is not something that is actively being done in European militaries, largely because of the hierarchical structures of the military. It's very hard to care about an individual soldier where in an army that is imbued with kind of class conflict. And so because the Continental Army is formed in 1775, specifically for the Revolutionary War, morale is something that they care about a lot more. Because they are brand new, they don't have any of this institutional baggage, if you will. And so morale is something that they can consider when they're training their soldiers. And also, given the cause, if you will, the point of the revolution is to turn these subjects into citizens, the emphasis on individuality in the soldiers becomes all the more important. The officers and the Continental Army need to convince the soldiers that by serving in the Continental Army, they are doing something worthy, and they are therefore going to become recipients of honor in this new republic. They will be a worthy citizen, regardless of what social rank they were before. So morale is a very new and potent, I guess, mechanism in the Continental Army in a way that is not considered as robustly in other armies. Obviously, just because morale isn't something that is considered in other armies doesn't mean it's important, but I think in the Revolutionary War, there is an added emphasis on fostering morale that doesn't exist in other armies in this period, and that's the crucial distinction. So morale in the British Army can be low or high, just like it can be in the Continental Army, but the Continental Army is actively trying to create morale and foster morale in a way that other armies aren't.
So, I mean, as you know from the historiography, I mean, there's a general view that you don't get first really kind of popular national armies or people in arms, as it were, during the Age of Revolution until the Wars of the French Revolution. Mm-hmm. And your research either implicitly or explicitly pushing back against that and arguing, or I don't want to put words in your mouth, would you be willing to claim that the men who serve in the Continental Army, the women who support them, are a people at arms in the words you portrayed?
I would, yes. I think the French army articulates that a lot better. I think they have a much more robust intellectual understanding of those principles, and that's why they get the attention that they do in the historiography, justifiably so. But I think in the Continental Army and during the American Revolution, you do have this people at arms mentality. You do have this really early understanding that they are fighting for a cause as a people. And so I absolutely am saying that it is happening slightly earlier than just the French Revolutionary Army, although, like, I think the French Revolutionary Army articulates it a lot better. Maybe actually because, as the Continental Army is the first to do so, and because it's a nascent institution, they're unable to articulate it quite as well because it's still developing, and the French Revolutionary Army, which has seen a lot of what has happened in the Continental Army and are able to articulate it better just that tenure later.
Right. Interesting. But of course, literacy isn't as widespread in France, in kind of revolutionary France, as it was in revolutionary America. It could be more pronounced in America.
You would think, yes. I think it's because it is probably more pronounced. No, I don't know. Individual soldiers' expressions of the cause is very interesting, and I'm using the cause broadly because I think for every soldier, they understand what they're fighting for slightly differently. None of them, as far as I can tell, have a robust intellectual understanding of the cause, or at least they certainly don't write about it in the way that people like Jefferson or Nathaniel Greene for an army officer or Alexander Hamilton do. Instead, they hear the principles that they are fighting for. Their officers are constantly telling them the reasons that they're fighting for and articulating it for them. And they see that and they find to manifest that. So an officer will say that you're fighting for the public good, and a soldier will hear to defend the public. And so if they are in an area that they have seen violence to settlers, be it from Native Americans, be it from the Crown forces, be it from other Tory populations, they will fight all the much harder and will be much more ardent in their expressions of the cause in their diaries than they are in any other time, because they really connect the cause to very practical relational forces in a way that officers don't do, if that makes sense.
It does. It does. Okay. Let me play devil's advocate here and push you a little bit.
You do love doing that.
I do love doing that. So as a New Englander, you and I share, or as New Englanders, I should say, unlike David, we share affiliations to certain sports teams. And when teams, the press loves to talk. As they do, yes, and they hate us because they ain't us, Kristen. But when teams win, sports journalists often talk about chemistry and the importance of chemistry. But the analytics people push back on this and say, no, teams that are winning always have good chemistry because they're on the winning side. So to kind of take that analogy, so morale, you know, the Revolutionary War, as you well know, could well have gone the other way. The rebels could have lost.
Easily.
We wouldn't have the independent United States, in which case, morale in the Continental Army might not appear to be quite as significant as it seems to you. Can you address that? That long-winded way of getting to things. By way of a swipe at David for not being a New Englander. Yes. But do you see what I mean?
I absolutely see what you mean. Yes. I would push back on that slightly. I think morale is very important to winning or losing a war, but it's not the be-all or end-all of winning and losing a war. And so you're right. And actually, for most of the conflict, it's very unclear who's going to win. But that has a bearing on soldiers' individual motivations. Obviously, when they win a battle, their spirits are elevated. When they don't win a battle, their spirits are dampened. And actually, the Continental Army spends a significant period of just, like, winning constantly. They have some really, really great victories, which are crucial, but they lose a lot. And so I think morale would have been just as important whether they won or whether they lost. The angle to which I approached it might be slightly different, and I guess my perception of the conflict going into my studies would have been different. But I think I would come to the same result, that the Continental Army is the first that really cared about the individual soldier, at least, or even if they didn't care, they understood the importance of the individual soldier. And whether the Continental Army won or lost the war, that would still be true. I think I would take a slightly different approach to it if they didn't win.
You
wouldn't that apply to loyalists, though? At least loyalist militia or loyalists who enlist in the British Army? I mean, they are Americans too. They are products of the same culture.
They are, but so one, militia is a whole another issue entirely, yeah, which I can talk about in a second. But yes, loyalists who enlist in the British Army, that would be true, except the British Army is not considering morale at this period. It's because the Continental Army was formed during this conflict that they were able to address this military theory in a very real way. So these theories basically emerge in the 1750s as a French military theorist that comes up with the idea. And basically he's a commander in the army and his soldiers are going to battle, and for no reason, because these are experienced professional soldiers who have been consistently fighting, they just can't fight in this battle. They all run away very early on and refuse to fight. And he's shocked because this has never happened before. It's not like this is their first time on the battlefield. It wasn't even their first time fighting this particular force. And he doesn't understand why this is. And so he starts thinking and he writes this pamphlet where basically he argues that you need to be aware of the human heart and what it can affect at different times, depending on circumstance. And this becomes kind of a new trend in military theory that is translated in English in the early 1770s. But it doesn't make any lasting changes in European theory until the 19th century. Because, as I said, the hierarchical structures that these armies exist from, because they have such strong institutional traditions, it's really hard to implement real lasting change. Whereas for the Continental Army, because it was founded during the war, the officers are able to emphasize this much earlier on from the very beginning. And I think that's the crucial distinction, is because it's not only that soldiers are aware they are important, but that the officers go out of the way to tell the soldiers that they are important. And that would ring true regardless of whether the British won the war or whether the Continental Army won the war, because the Continental Army would still have actively tried to do that even if they weren't successful.
Well, excellent. Thank you, Kristen. So, by way of wrapping up, and then I'll hand things over to David and see if he's got any questions for you, but as you know, there was a documentary on in the United States last week on Ulysses Grant on the History Channel. It got a lot of attention. And one of the things in terms of the social media response to that documentary that came, the coverage was, and the response was generally favorable about, again, I'd be interested to hear David's views. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that people observed was the lack of women military historians who were interviewed in that documentary. And you are a woman military historian, so I guess I'd ask you to respond to that. But I'd ask you, but more generally, I think my question for you is, how do you find it as a woman doing military history? Because, as you know, again, better than me, there are relatively few women military historians.
There are. So I will say, in terms of the documentary, there was one on Washington that came out recently as well, also by the History Channel, that I think had a slightly better gender balance. And I should also say, it's not that women historians or women military historians don't exist. I'm not sure why they weren't included in the documentary. It could be scheduling. It could just be that they didn't think it was necessary to include them. But I think it's awful there was a woman or less women historians included in it. My experiences as a woman who studies military history have been interesting. And I should say they're kind of separated. So there's my experience as an academic within the academic community doing military history, and then there's my experiences as an academic dealing with the public doing military history. In terms of as an academic with other academics, I've had no issues being a female military historian. Everyone has been extremely encouraging, both military historians and non-military historians. I know a significant number of female military historians who are encouraging, I think because especially those who are older than me and more experienced than me, they had a very different entrance into the field than I did. And I think the field of military history is very conscious of the fact that optically it looks bad. There are a lot of men historically who study it, and there are a lot of men who, like in the documentary, are highlighted for studying it, and women are less than that. But because of that, they really go out of their way to make it a very welcoming environment and are very supportive. And so in terms of from other academics, I've had no problems whatsoever. The public's response to me has been interesting. And I think all military historians get this. I'm not entirely sure it's exclusively because I'm a woman, although I do think I get it more often because I am a woman. Whenever you study military history, you're giving a public lecture or you are talking to random members of the public about this, the things you study, they often are very interested, but they also really want to talk about specific things about military history that they know. And because I study morale, I can talk about battles with you all day if you would like me to. I can talk about the weaponry used, but that's not what I do. I focus very strongly on soldiers, and morale largely is involved in everything that leads up to the battle, that gets the soldiers to the battlefield and gets them fighting. It doesn't really matter what happens on the battlefield except to say that they won or that they lost, with a few exceptions. And so because of that, I find people really want to talk about minutiae of military detail with me. And whether that is just because they are very interested in the minutiae of military detail, or whether it's an inherent, okay, you study soldiers, but do you really understand what's going on the battlefield? And sometimes the tone I get from, they tend to be older gentlemen I get the tone from, is less than ideal. However, I like to work on the assumption that it is just they are very interested in military minutiae, and if that is what they want to talk about, I am more than happy to do that. So overall, I think it has been a positive experience, although it is an interesting experience some of the time.
Thanks, Kristen. David, over to you. I mean, do you have any questions, Kristen, or any or a response to anything, any of the things she's had to say?
Well, I was just, you know, one thing that sort of always just puzzles me about the Continental Army and the way in which the war was fought, and I was wondering if you could, you know, talk about this a little bit. You've got the Continental Army that George Washington et al. Is leading, and then you've got these militias. And I'm gathering mm-hmm. that your work is about the people who are in the Continental Army and not people who are in the militias. When people Correct. Think about the Revolution, they often think about the militia and the Minutemen and that whole mythology, if that's the right yes. term for that. Could you speak to about how morale works in those two different venues and the ways in which those things are different? Like what's the difference between the militia and the Continental Army? What's the difference in the experience of the people who are in those kinds of units?
Absolutely. That's a really good question, and was something that I needed to consider for a long time when I started this project, whether I was going to include the militia or not. And eventually I decided not to. And the reasons I decided not to, as you commented, are because the experiences of militia soldiers and the expectations of militia versus soldiers in the Continental Army are very different for a number of reasons. And there's a caveat to this. So when I say I don't study the militia, that is true technically, although the year 1775 poses some difficulties in regard, because the Continental Army was formed after Lexington and Concord had already happened, after there was already a very large group of men assembled to fight the British. And so the Continental Army is formed, and by that I mean Congress officially said, yes, we will create an army. And then they looked at the men who had assembled at Cambridge and said, you are the army. And so for much of 1775, although they are called the Continental Army, it functions much more as a militia. And so I don't consider the militia, but 1775 is a weird ground. And the other time I do consider militia is when mutinies occur in the Continental Army, as long as it is not a mutiny that is explicitly and only the militia, and some of those do happen, if militia units are involved in a larger mutiny that includes Continental Army soldiers or was formed by Continental Army soldiers, then I will consider them in that capacity. But the reason I decided overall not to look at the militia and the Continental Army, one is because that would just be a lot of work, but two, because their experiences diverge pretty drastically. So Continental Army soldiers join the army, they enlist in the army for a set period of time, and a lot of them extend their enlistments and a lot of them do not extend their enlistments, but they are in service, they have signed paper where they have said an oath saying that they will serve for an explicit period of time. And when they do that, they're guaranteed certain things. So they're meant to be, they're not always, they're meant to be paid. They're meant to be supplied by the army or by the colony that they are representing. And for all intents and purposes, for the duration of their enlistment, they are in the service of the army. They have to do what the army tells them. They have to march where the army tells them to march. They have to camp when the army tells them to march. If they want to go home, they have to request a furlough. I mean, or reserve, but in general, there are official procedures that have to be followed if you are enlisted in the army. And that service, if say you were from Massachusetts, that service could bring you all the way to Virginia or South Carolina. There is no limits on where the army will go. You just have to go where you're told. Whereas the militia who served during the period have a very different experience. One, because militias are local, which means that if the army needs help, when they're in a certain location, they will call upon local militias to join them. If the army is fighting in Virginia, they're not going to call the Massachusetts militia to come help them. And so because it's local, militia are very, in a very real way, involved in the defense of people that they understand to be their family and potentially their countrymen, although I'm not sure a lot of them would use that exact phrase. Because militia are not officially enlisted in the army, they get away with a lot more than Continental Army soldiers do. If militia are meant to stay in camp with other soldiers, but if they sneak home, the army can punish them, but they don't really have the authority to do so in a way that they do their own soldiers. And so militia live in this kind of state of flux where they oscillate between being civilians and being soldiers and are at any time simultaneously both and also neither of them. And because of that, with morale, which is so dependent on very practical things like food and clothing and paychecks and shelter, the militia don't have those worries in the same way. And so you could do a study that compared morale or attempted to compare morale between the militia and the Continental Army, but I think it would become very convoluted and very hard to separate the two in some ways, and then in other ways it would be apparent that their situations are just kind of vastly different. Both very important, I should say, but they function very differently, and I think those differences when studying morale are crucial.
Yeah, I mean, it's always struck me sort of the ways in which you sort of understand what the revolution was and how it worked is different depending on whether you think the revolution is won by, you know, citizen, soldier, militiaman kind of mentality versus one by a professional army led by highly trained professionals. You know, I think it says something different about the sort of mythology of the revolution. Right, I think we're at a time for last drops. Kristen, you got a last drop you want to share with people?
I do. So I thought a lot about what I was going to say for this last drop. And actually, maybe your next episode would be a better place for the last drop. But given everything that's going on in the world, I, as an American who lives in Scotland, have been struck by the limits of what I can and can't do to help. As a student, my financial abilities are limited, and so I can't donate to different groups that I would like to as much as I would like to. But one thing that, as a PhD student, I'm very good at is reading. And so I just wanted to highlight two books that I think are very timely, although both of them are at least a decade old. The first is The Fire Next Time by James Baldwin. James Baldwin is my favorite writer. I think he's a beautiful prose man. And in the current situation, there's something very sobering about reading a very short series of essays, I guess, that was written in the early 60s that resonates so strongly today. And my second recommendation is The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, which is celebrating its 10th year of publication this year. It came out in 2010. And it is a really revolutionary book. It's one of the first books that I read that genuinely blew my mind. Like, it very radically shifted my perception of how things in the United States work. And I think it did that for a lot of people. And given the book basically considers the penal system, and that is to say from the moment someone is arrested until well after that person is released from prison, how their lives is affected by that experience and how racially motivated a lot of this system is. And I think both The Fire Next Time and The New Jim Crow are really excellent books to read in the current time. I think they're very eye-opening, and would recommend both of them to anyone.
Oh, excellent recommendations. Okay. My recommendation is going to be slightly lighter for people who are looking to not sort of understand the moment, but to go sort of escape to a slightly different moment. And that's a podcast called Wind of Change, which is produced by some of the same people who do Pod Save America and those, that whole sort of panoply of shows. It's about the pop song by the Scorpions from 1990, Wind of Change, which I will not sing for anybody because it's I can't sing. And I can't really whistle well either, and there's a good little whistling bit in the song. But it's a sort of a pivotal and a very important song in through the end of the Cold War. Wind of Change is a German band that sang in English. And it's sort of a very politically inspired song about the sort of fall of communism. And the premise of the podcast, which is sort of an investigatory show, is whether or not the CIA was responsible for writing this song as a sort of tool to expedite the demise of the Soviet Union. They're about sort of halfway through, I guess, broadcasting episodes of it, but it's good fun. It's serious enough where you feel like you're actually potentially learning something, but also silly enough where it's a sort of good escape from everything else.
And to prove that this is not scripted, that was mine too.
Oh, geez. Okay.
No. Well, I would heartily endorse yours, David. I think that it's an amazing podcast. It's very entertaining. It's very well done. And it goes back. It looks at the history of the kind of State Department sponsoring jazz tours during the Cold War of Europe and the Soviet Union. It's fabulous. So definitely give it a listen.
Yes, good fun, and it, you know, there is some history, even if it's somewhat speculative. Some of it great. Obviously, we're going to have a show later this week to sort of address some of the hugely historic things that are going on at the moment, but I think today we need to thank Kristen for joining us today. That was a lot of fun.
Thank you, Kristen.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right, to everyone else there, stay safe and healthy to the extent that one can during all this. Frank, talk to you soon.
Okay, cheers, David. Cheers, Kristen.
Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.